ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's hard to get your loved ones to change their habits, let alone change world history. But that's exactly what happened with apartheid.
A demonstrator has run right through the play.
Australians and millions of others took a stand and helped to bring the racist South African regime to its knees. I'm Sisonke Msimang, and join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. ABC Rewind, Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. I'm Kate Evans.
And I'm Cassie McCullough. Today, well, as always, some of the latest and greatest books being released in Australia and around the world.
We're talking new fiction, both novels and short stories. And I guess one of the things we might wonder, Cassie, is whether, as we talk every week about what fiction does, whether it's shining a light on the world or whether it's distorting that prism somehow.
Mm-hmm. Or taking us away from the world. Perhaps the best ones do both. Well, today, in this particular occasion, an Irish country girl who's tracked across 25 years of her life in Mary Costello's A Beautiful Loan.
Singer-songwriter Tim Rogers is going to read that one with us. And nine American stories, sharp, honed, surprising, in Lauren Groff's Brawler.
Hannah Kent will join us to discuss that one. But first to contemporary London and a mystery set between the middle class and the upper lower class, Kate.
All those class levels and maybe some generational tension in there too.
John Lanchester is a novelist and essayist. He writes for the London Review of Books. I think he's a contributing editor there. His subjects are quite often in nonfiction about money and technology and cryptocurrency, which somehow he kind of makes fun.
And he's written two books about financial systems, Whoops, Why Everyone Owes Everyone and No One Will Pay, and How to Speak Money. And some of his fiction follows the money too. One of his novels is called Capital, which was also made into a TV series, and there's also The Debt to Pleasure.
So here we are with this new novel, and it's called Look What You Made Me Do. It's a very powerful title, and other people have used it. Actually, Kate, I know you're a massive Taylor Swift fan. She's also got a song called Look What You Made Me Do.
Although I did hear an interview with John Lanchester, and he said he'd called his novel that in the preparation before her song came out.
Oh, really?
That's what he reckoned anyway.
That was what, 2017? But not a trace of her feud with Kanye West or Kim Kardashian in this novel. But there are a lot of different tensions. And some of those, Kate, as we've already alluded to, are about class and about money.
And I think a lot of it about generations as well. Although I'm curious about the way that the characters at the heart of this novel are identified as boomers, when I would have thought they were Generation X's because they're in their 50s around about now, and we meet two of them as the novel opens, Kate and Jack. I mean, how would you describe these two?
Look, this is a very, very English book, and part of it is all those little signifiers of your position in the world and your level of comfort and your level of superiority above those immediately below you that seem to be very important to the British. Let me just read the first paragraph. The voice in this alternates between a woman called Kate, who's the said boomer, who's in her 50s, and another woman called Phoebe. So here we are with Kate. Every successful marriage has its own private language. Now, that's something that Jane Austen would be quite proud of, I think. I was finishing my makeup in front of the bathroom mirror, the least flattering and therefore the most fit-for-purpose light in the house, when I heard my husband call upstairs. "Want your body, disco girl," said Jack. This meant, "Please hurry up, we're going to be late." It was a reference to an old New Yorker cartoon. So there we are. We know the world. We've been there before, thanks to BBC television and other class satire novels of the last 50 years.
I'm glad you used the word satire, though, because although it does have all of these little markers, like the fact Jack is an architect and the house is very designed and it has the right sort of tiles and moments and space, he is skewering this a bit, and it's sort of sharp and slick in the way that he sets us up to understand who these people are, the types of lives they're living, the particular type of smugness that is a combination of privilege and money and a certain sort of left politics, where Jack, this successful architect, likes to call himself a socialist, for example.
I think the term that John Lanchester uses later on is lefty posh, which I might make a note of because I think it's one of the classes we have here in Australia as well. But the fact that their private language within this marriage contains an ancient reference to a New Yorker cartoon, I kind of love as well, because who hasn't met people like that before? Anyway, they are off to dinner. They're close friends. Some young people are also there, which is a little unfortunate. I mean, it's a night out. It's kind of entertaining. One of the most entertaining parts for me was the way Jack just enters the house and goes on this massive rant about Yotam Ottolenghi, which actually I have to confess is something that I often do myself, as my brother, one of my brothers, is a complete Ottolenghi devotee. Yeah. He just deconstructs Ottolenghi in such a brilliant way. I thought immediately, I've got to send this book to my brother.
Well, and Jack's bombastic and opinionated and likes to be the centre of attention, and he likes to make these provocative statements, whether it's about architecture or food or, you know, he's often holding forth on the way the world works. And although it's sort of funny and bombastic and probably annoying and his friends love him and he's funny, there's this moment when the younger couple who are at this dinner party, Kate looks over and sees the look on the young woman's face, and she recognises in it a startling weariness, even a contempt. Perhaps, the character goes on, I'm projecting, but what I felt I was seeing was an intergenerational dislike, a mid-30s person looking at people a quarter of a century older than her and seeing a complacent affluence and unearned self-confidence and assuredness born of never having had to do anything difficult. And so that tension, I mean, that set up, what, five pages in this novel. And we're off and running.
There's a reference to them having bought houses when they were cheap and feeling smug about how clever they were, not actually realising it was just a fluke of timing.
Well, and this dinner party is in two London terraces next to each other that have been knocked through so that they have this enormous house that we're told, you will have seen photos of a house, of this house in
Architectural Digest or something. Yeah, yeah. So taking up two homes where a couple live, houses that could have been home to 10 people at least. So there you are, and it's a kind of entertaining. We've been there before. We know these scenes. It's funny, and off they trot into the night having drunk some fairly nice wine.
We're also getting a portrait of a relationship. I mean, we've got the nicknames they give each other, their private language, but there is a warmth to that as it goes on. And what I liked actually was the description of the sort of intimacy of this long-term relationship, the way that they understand and see each other, and she recognises his warmth and his generosity and all of the things that she actually does adore about him. And that's sort of central to understanding who she is and this life that they've lived together for decades now.
Yes, more than 40 years they've been together. So that's chapter one. In fact, something key happens at the end of chapter one. Kate heads on up to bed. Jack's going to the loo, calls out something a little ribald to her in their private language. I know you want to hear what it is, so I'll read it. I may just take advantage of you while you sleep, he called after me. I'll stick it in without so much as a by your leave. There you go. That's the tone of their sexy talk. Anyway, tragically, and this is a massive spoiler, that is the last thing he ever says. Dies on the toilet.
And we're only 23 pages in. And so then the novel sort of shifts again because we see this woman, our narrator, Kate, dealing with grief, dealing with friendships, trying to remake her way in the world. And after the loss of this huge relationship, this force in her life, they didn't have any children, their life was lived very much with the two of them.
And their jobs. She's a civil servant, quite high up. She actually works, she goes into jails and talks to people who believe themselves to be innocent and is part of this innocence project, helping them perhaps find recourse out of the prison system.
So he was an architect, she was a prison visitor. She's having to move on with her life. And after a couple of months when she's really been consumed by grief and not really wanting to see people, she slowly starts to reconnect. And when she does reconnect, everybody's talking about a new show.
What does she do? She goes back to her old book club. So there you go. That's the power that a book club can have. And that this one, which is being hosted, I think, by Daphne, who's a little interfering but well-meaning, they are all talking about this new show on Netflix, which is white hot, white lotus hot, in fact. It's called Cheating. And one of the women says, what about the first line where he says,
I want your body, disco doll.
Which is not a line you hear often unless you have a very old joke about a cartoon in The New Yorker.
And so suddenly she's hearing intimate moments from the life that she'd shared with Jack, you know, that sort of secret language of a couple, and moments that she thinks
she
nobody
goes stone
else...
cold, like the shock of that, hearing that phrase, she's just frozen. She can't believe it. And the more she hears, the more she's convinced that this is actually Jack's words that have somehow come out in this Netflix show called Cheating. So she goes, leaves immediately, and of course she goes and watches it. And everything, all the dialogue of this show comes directly from her life and out of the mouth of her dead husband, who in this show, which is about a 50-year-old man who's having a affair with a 30-something woman.
Who is a writer, the character in the show. So what's going on? What does this mean? There's no question for either us as readers or for Kate as the narrator that these really are the words from her life. So it's not that we think it's some sort of psychological projecting.
Mm.
These are moments from her life.
Yeah, there's no other explanation.
So that's one way of reading this book, is this sort of psychological drama. What the hell is going on?
But she's devastated. The man that she's loved her entire life appears to have been cheating on her at least once, and quite in an extended form, and has been telling this other woman every intimate detail of their lives, including their sexual activities.
So it's like a doubled or tripled cheating. It's taken her past away. It's increasing her sense of grief. But then the story shifts when we get a couple of different things. We get scripts from the show and we get insights into Phoebe.
So we begin to enter a alternating narrative with a younger 30-something woman, the screenwriter of this show. But there's also other things thrown in, like magazine articles, bits from the script, and I liked that. I think format-wise that was fresh and exciting. Every new form that Lanchester used, I liked that as a reading experience.
And we get a sense of this young woman, Phoebe, as she's super smart, she's cutting, she's intense, she's in control of that public version of herself. But then we learn more about her life, in particular her relationship with her nightmare mother. And I thought that was also really compellingly written.
Yeah, she's a mother who can never be pleased, who's always criticising, who actually comes up with active ways of making her children feel bad. And it's a unique portrait of a mother. I mean, it's worth reading just for that. We also go back into the early lives of Jack and
Kate. We get Kate. The sort of origin story of the relationship.
Yes, when they're at some sort of Oxbridge University. I think it was Oxford, actually. Couldn't quite figure it out. We won't give any more spoilers away. But then the plot unfolds more. And the central question, I think, is, well, what is the message? Who is the anti-hero in the book? And why can one event set off a chain reaction of vindictive acts of reprisal and revenge, and who's a fair target? Because there are many people in this book who are unfairly victims of revenge. So it's a complex question that John Lanchester is asking us to think about.
And it takes on that question of likability and relatability or not, which is one of the simple ways that people often deal with fiction. And a lot of that's upended precisely on that question of revenge and targeting and who does what to whom.
Now, I'm going to say something mean about this book, and that is that I think that Andrew O'Hagan's Caledonian Road does a much better satire of the layers of English society. If you haven't read that one, make sure you do. But this is an interesting book, not entirely successful in solving the mystery and the problem it creates, but nonetheless fun.
Yeah, fun, entertaining, slick, is probably does at least four different things, some of which you're not ready for and can be surprised by. But it's an entertaining read.
Yeah, you won't put it down.
And that is Look What You Made Me Do by John Lanchester, published by Faber. Now on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, let's meet this week's guests, singer-songwriter and performer Tim Rogers and novelist Hannah Kent. Hello.
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 Hello, both of you.
This is my favourite part of the month.
Oh.
Right answer.
Hello, Hannah.
Hello, Tim.
Now, you're both memoirists. Your book Detours came out in 2018, Tim, and Hannah's Always Home, Always Homesick just last year. What is that like? I mean, now that you've done it, both of you, is it exposing? Is it just terrifying before you do it and then it's okay or what? Go first, Hannah.
Goodness, I feel like I haven't had enough time to really sit with it. You know what? I think I made a few good calls in the drafting process. And if I hadn't made those in terms of what I wasn't going to include in the memoir, I probably would be in a position of regret now. I remember having a conversation with my wife where she was like, look, anything outside this tight trinity of subjects, just don't include it. But I don't know, maybe in 5 years' time I'll read it and cringe and think I've changed my mind. I have no idea. Tim, has time given you that kind of reflection?
I'm still a little taken aback when people want to talk about it, because when I go and do shows, I sell it and it comes up in conversation, and generally people want to talk about anxiety or about drinking or all the fun bits. And I'm a bit taken aback because I don't really have anything to add on that apart from speak to a professional. I didn't feel I had to avoid anything. I just threw it all down, and it was my five editors that said, yeah, you may want to consider this. This may come back to get you. And I thought that's what was required to go into the margins and to go into uncomfortability. But they said, no, you're getting pretty uncomfortable here, and brought it back. So it's definitely something I'll never do again. Would much rather work on the impossibilities of fiction.
Oh, are you working on fiction? Is that something you're playing with?
Oh, my life is a fiction. Yes, I am. And it's a complete grind, difficult, and I love reading people I respect greatly, a couple of who are in the room now, talking about writing. They say it's discipline and approaching it that way. And it'll probably take 30 years.
But, Tim, you're a songwriter, so you're used to writing things that are short and contained. Does that help when you think about writing in other forms?
No, it doesn't. I love writing songs. My wife asked me a couple of months ago, is there anything about touring that you like? Because I was complaining about probably air conditioning. And I said, after thinking about it for quite a while, yeah, the writing. I adore writing songs. And writing fiction isn't because I feel I have to. It's because I've been asked to give it a try and would like to try something different, doing some theatre shows this year as well, and putting us out of your comfort zone, because writing songs is so much fun. It can't possibly be worthwhile when something is that much fun. Although...
Well, Tim, anyone who can write Heavy Heart can write just about anything and I'll read it. So do it.
I missed that. Let's move on.
But Hannah, what about writing things that are very short? I mean, would you write a song? Do you write poetry?
I would give a foot to be able to write a song. To me, I mean, because I love listening to music, and actually it's a massive source of inspiration for me whenever I come to a new project. One of the things I do when I sort of make space for the ideas to come is to basically find the soundtrack, to find artists that I want to listen to that somehow evoke the emotional landscape I want to capture. I would love to be able to plunge into that kind of emotional depth with that speed through becoming a songwriter. But I cannot. Maybe one day, but far out it's hard.
Yeah, and Björk makes it look really easy.
Yeah, super easy, super easy.
Picking up on your Iceland.
We're back in Iceland. And we're back.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine if I come out with like a Björk-esque album now? No one will see it coming.
Oh, my God, I love that.
Full regalia, full face of makeup, next Writers Festival. It's going to be great.
And the swan dress, of course.
Oh, God.
And then there's all the sagas. So, of course, they do long forms as well. So all of this is leading on to the question of short stories, because you're reading some short stories.
I had no idea. I was thinking, this is interesting, seeing where this goes. Okay, so of course, Kate always has a plan. All right, so short stories is where we're going.
Well, and I'm curious, and you know, as a writer, Hannah, what is it about the short story that you think makes it so powerful?
I think it's in many ways a similar kind of qualities that makes a song powerful. I think it's the ability to reach an emotional depth quickly, and I think that's done through a very precise kind of language and a very concise choice of language. It's about conveying as much in as few words as possible. Every word counts. I'm a failed short story writer. I've never published a short story. I've written many. In fact, the other day I was going through some of them. I mean, they're terrible, but it was surprising to me how many paragraphs have found their way into novels. Oh. So, I mean, they're always, I love them as an exercise, but I see them as an exercise in novel writing, as, you know, in terms of germinating ideas or characters. But it's something I would actually love to do, is to become better at writing short stories, because I think it would show an improvement more generally in myself as a writer. But I love reading them. I love reading them for the same reason as I love reading poetry. I love listening to music. I have all my favourite musicians are singer-songwriters. Because of that, I think it's, I mean, what a talent to sort of just have, you know, even 2,000 words and to be able to make something deeply memorable or life-changing, to kind of create the art that's going to stay with people for the rest of their lives. I mean, I need 110,000 words to even try and get close to that. I would love to be able to do it faster.
Yeah, the bijou of the literary world. Okay, well, let's get into this one, this short story collection. It's the latest from the writer Lauren Groff. Well, if you don't know who Lauren Groff is, where have you been? She is an American novelist, short story writer, and owner of an independent bookshop in Florida. And, you know, every second person we talk to seems to mention her as someone they admire or have tried to imitate. But she's actually not written all that much, Kate.
And also she writes in a couple of different styles. So she's written historical fiction, notably Matrix, which is set in a 12th century nunnery, and The Vaster Wilds, which is set in early colonial America. And even though they're different places and different times, she's imagining them as part of a series, a triptych. She hasn't written the third one yet. She's also written contemporary novels, including Fates and Furies, which was the story of a marriage. I really liked that, because halfway through the book, she sort of turned it all upside down and inside out and rewrote the story. But she's written a number of collections of short stories, including Florida and Delicate Edible Birds. And actually, Hannah, you are a fan of her short fiction, aren't you?
I'm a massive fan of Lauren Groff for a multitude of reasons. The first book of hers that I read was Florida, and I loved it. I enjoy short stories for the reasons I said earlier, but I think it's quite special when you find a collection where all the stories are in conference with one another and together kind of create, you know, something slightly more symphonic, a greater sort of meaning. They were also equally weighted, and the collection itself just evoked place in this visceral, you know, dark, deeply uneasy kind of attitude that, I mean, I just have to look at the book on my shelf and I feel it again. I feel like I've been to Florida just through reading those stories. I love them.
And it's all full of steaminess and hurricanes and wild weather and sort of strange moments in these stories as well, things that are underground or looking out from underneath a house. I mean, her perspective on things is really interesting in that collection.
Yeah, lots of strange people and people on the edge and people doing odd things as though they've been sitting on this sort of rising pressure of, I don't know, internal chaos or dissatisfaction, and it started to leak out and kind of combine with the surrounds. It's I don't know, I almost can't really describe it, but it's just a tremendous collection.
So she seems to be able to create entire worlds in each of her short stories, often with these really surprisingly intense moments. And so this new collection called Brawler, there's 9 stories. Which one do you think we should start with?
Oh, this is so hard. I think we should start with the first one, which is called The Wind, because it's the gut punch that opens the collection. Without giving too much away, we basically follow children who we are told quite early on is the mother and the uncles of the person narrating this story. So we know that they grow up and they survive and they have families. But we follow these children essentially as they try to leave their abusive father with their mother, who is on the verge of collapse but is doing this last wild, desperate thing to try and ensure the safety of herself and her children. God, it's harrowing, but it's also filled with these moments of grace, these moments of generosity and courage from the people who see them, who try to aid them. And it sets you up, I think, for the rest of this collection. It's this very strong introduction to violence and aggression and the way in which it has been allowed to grow within the community in which this story is set. And I think it really sets the tone for much is what to follow, even if the themes and the subjects do differ a little.
And it's so interestingly precise because in this first story, The Wind, we're told that this is a story that the narrator's mother has told her over and over again and told from the perspective of 3 children, a girl and her 2 brothers, on the day that they are escaping the father. 2 of the boys in the story, they're Joey and Ralphie. There's this paragraph when she suddenly flips time. So we're in the moment of the story. And it says, my younger uncle reached out his small hand and Joseph, who hated all show of affection, held it. Ralphie had a fishing accident when I was a teenager and my cold, dry Uncle Joseph fell apart at the funeral, sobbing and letting snot run down his face, all twisted grotesquely in pain. Between a full stop and a next paragraph, we've suddenly been shot decades and decades into the future for this one little moment, and then we're back in the story, and that felt controlled to me.
I agree. I mean, one of the reasons why I love Lauren Groff is because I'm a little bit obsessed with her as a writer myself. I'm really fascinated by her creative process. One of the things she, I think, quite famously does is she writes all her short stories and her novels, I believe, by longhand. And then when she's finished, she puts them in a banker's drawer and then she writes it again without referring to the first draft. And she does this again and again so that it's almost as if her own memory will kind of preserve what is necessary. But I think the result is that when you read her short stories particularly, you get a real sense that she knows this story. She knows everything which is happening off page as well. And that's why we often have these little jumps backward and forward in time, which do feel so controlled and also recontextualize what is happening in the more immediate present story. And I think that is such a skill. And I think it's testament to her patience with herself as a writer and also her trust in the process of drafting and also her rigour.
I just wanted to ask with the comment about it being controlled, whether that was a slight criticism or just that, as Hannah said then, you know you're in good hands and feeling under that control.
Oh, for me it was a compliment, Tim. I felt like controlled in the sense that it's sort of precise and perfectly calibrated so that there's nothing baggy in the story. It feels like she knows exactly what she's doing. And sometimes you get a whole family drama in one short paragraph. So it feels like she knows who these characters are, where they are, what's happening, even in their bodies. They're sort of very embodied writing in a way.
It's an interesting question though, Tim, because I agree, when you feel the author is in control, you can really sit back and relax. But are you suggesting that you like a little looseness?
No, it was a genuine question because that word control can have connotations of manipulation with the writer's process about writing in longhand and then putting in a banker's drawer. I can see that room straight away. I was just wondering if processes are something that authors of particularly fiction feel comfortable giving out, as if these are secrets that we can't let anybody else know because this is my method, but it's a particularly fascinating one. I mean, songwriters use this one: if you can't remember the song the next day without recording it, then it wasn't worth it anyway, which there's a bit of bunkum associated with that because you always forget something.
Didn't Keith Richards wake up in the middle of the night and write down some lick, which became, I don't know, Satisfaction,
I believe, was the song. Yes, yes. Yes. Keith, his approach to the truth is a little loose.
It's,
I'll go with it.
Okay.
For me, I think control, maybe a better word would be you're always assured that she is well aware of her own intention within every story. And I think because of that, actually, the opposite is true. Rather than it being kind of limited or locked in, I feel like she's able to go to some very strange places or take more creative risks because she is so aware of how she wants to bring it all together. And so as a reader, when you encounter these massive time jumps or just, you know, decades can pass in a sense, I think there's in one story, she simply says time passes and suddenly we're decades onwards. You can kind of go with it. You're never jolted out of the narrative. She's earned your trust in her, if that makes sense.
Well, one of the other stories, there's one that I particularly liked called Between the Shadow and the Soul, and it's a story of a couple, Willie and Eliza. They've been together for decades, and we find out about how they met when they were quite young. He was a beautiful schoolboy. He was about 16 and she was in her early 20s. So there was some sort of scandal and drama in this small community about the fact they got together. But the majority of the story takes place when she's in her early 50s. She's retired as the postmistress in this small community. And then she's a bit lost. She doesn't quite know what to do with her life. And it's both a portrait of a relationship, which she often does, and then we go back and forward in all these sort of small dramas, which she makes absolutely fascinating. And she uses words like looking at his face, who she's looked at for 40 years, and she sees sorrow and rage and a kind of mad, obstinate joy. And rage, sorrow, joy, I think she writes all those really well.
Yeah, she does. I think rage is something I kept thinking of reading all of these stories. I don't know whether it's Groff's own rage kind of bubbling away through there, whether that's where the place where a lot of these stories have come from. But I think many of these characters are trying to control their own, you know, huge kind of floods of anger or dissatisfaction or their, you know, resentment. I think violence is something I kept coming back to, both ways in which it is very direct and explicit, like in the first story. But also America, I think she seems to suggest, is also an inherently violent story. There's a lot of violence which is permissible within, I guess, you know, society and the kind of ongoing kind of creep of damage that that causes both for people who suffer from it, but also the people who perpetrate that violence as well. But I think there's something very muscular in her stories. There's a real sense of momentum, you know, just there's no, like you mentioned earlier, there's no flabbiness. And part of that comes from her knowing exactly what she's trying to say, but it's also the prose itself and even the descriptors. There's this lovely line in that story that you mentioned, Kate, Between the Shadow and the Soul, where she's just describing a dinner party and the dog under the table. And she says, under the tables, the dog laid his broad, blonde head on people's knees and gazed adoringly upward, the slut. And it just made me, you just laugh out loud in these little unexpected moments. And yeah, she's tremendous. I read most of those stories once as a reader, and then I read them again to work out exactly how she'd sort of achieved the effect she has.
I love your forensic reading, Hannah.
I love it. I know. I want to know how they do it, you know.
Let's take it apart.
She's one of those writers who you don't really know where a story is going. And sometimes it'll be set up. Like there's another one that is just wonderful. It's about 80 pages long. It's called What's the Time, Mr. Wolf? And it starts with an Independence Day family dinner, so on the 4th of July. And it's this rich, messy family. And there's so much in it about their conflicts with each other and their backstories. And there's all these characters. They're all called Charles or Chaz or Chip. And it could just work staying at that dinner party because all the drama's there. We're in the house. The house is beautifully described. All the bodies are there. And then there's one small boy at that dinner party, and we end up following his life for decades. And it takes us in places that we really don't see coming. And you think you know what the story might do. You think there might be some sort of resolution, and it just doesn't happen like that. And I thought that story, and I have not been able to stop thinking about it.
It's amazing. I think this is the thing. I mean, like you say, she could have really just finished it with the, you know, probably expected family conflict, the kind of conflict you'd expect a family of privilege and immense wealth to have during that kind of celebration or dinner party. But then you realise, as you continue reading what I think is probably a novella within this collection, that because we have been introduced to this boy Chip as a boy, as a child, it contextualises and it colours everything else that he goes on to do. And you find yourself towards the end, without kind of revealing what happens, in this uncomfortable position of seeing him potentially do something abhorrent, but also still nonetheless having empathy for him, because we have met him much earlier in this place of innocence where he's essentially lying, he's floating in a pond. And she draws it so beautifully. And then you always carry this with you, even as, you know, things become heightened and he makes terrible decisions and you see the way his own privilege and wealth have really just kind of strangled him and deformed him into something else entirely. She's so clever. And I think she does that with so many of these other stories as well. There's another one called Birdie, which is about a bunch of high school girls kind of reuniting at the deathbed of one of their friends who is about to pass away from cancer. And they're talking about the worst things that they have ever done. And they're all sort of making these kind of bedside confessions. And that in itself, again, could be a perfectly serviceable story. But then she elevates it. And I think one of the things she's doing by elevating it is applying a kind of grace. There's always a moment of grace or of reprieve or of the possibility of redemption in a lot of these stories. And I think that's one of the things that, well, certainly for me, makes them so memorable.
All right, well, that sounds like it's definitely worth a look. It's by Lauren Groff and it's called Brawler. You're listening to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, on air, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your fine quality podcasts. I'm Cassie McCullough here with Kate Evans, as always, and guests today, writer Hannah Kent, whose books include Burial Rites, Devotion, and Always Home, Always Homesick, and songwriter and performer Tim Rogers from the band UMI and many other musical escapades and adventures.
And we're turning now to the latest from Irish writer Mary Costello, who first made her name as a writer of short stories, our big theme for the day, and her collection The China Factory was shortlisted for the Irish Book Award.
Now, she's also written the novels Academy Street, The River Capture, Barcelona, and now this new one, which you, Tim, and you, Kate, have read. It's called A Beautiful Loan, and that's L-O-A-N. Who, what, when, where, why? The usual questions. Let's start with where, Kate?
The where is mostly Dublin. The when, well, it's a story that covers about 25 years in one woman's life, and that woman is Anna, and that's the sound of me turning pages to get to the prologue.
Uh-oh, a prologue, I see.
Well, it's only one page long.
Hmm. I do like a prologue. I'm not saying they're bad, but I can instantly, I've already got a little sense of the formality.
Well, she says, my name is Anna, and for some time now I've been trying to account for certain events in my life, my adult life, that is, which from the vantage point of 45 years I often find baffling. And then she explains it's not the events that she's necessarily wanting to make sense of. She's trying to understand what went on in her mind for over two decades. So who is this woman, Anna? Tim?
Sorry,
I made a complete hash of that, and so much so that Cassie's laughing.
Hannah, meet Anna. Sorry. Anna, meet Cassie, meet Kate. I'm Tim, your therapist. Oh,
well, okay. There is a bit of a theme of therapists.
Yes, and a young woman, I don't think she's naive, but similar to the lead character in Academy Street, one of Mary Costello's earlier novels, this Irish, waifish, dreamy, quite bookish young woman falling in love with dreadful other humans.
Well, and because after that one page prologue, Tim, we then flick back to when, as you say, she's this young woman, she's 19. Hmm. It's in the mid-1980s and we're in a nightclub. And she sees that night as the moment that sort of sets everything running. So what happens?
What I quite liked is that they didn't, Mary Costello doesn't paint this as, hey, this is 1985, this is the soundtrack, this is what we're wearing. It's straight into, she finds this older gentleman, Peter Gallagher, very attractive, and he's wooing of her as she gets drunker. And what happens, and her devotion to him and her need to be with him, and he's not only older, but a very distant kind of character. He's not particularly affectionate. Seems to be living a secret life. And he does live another life that doesn't involve her at all, which pains her. And then we find out later that he's a bit of a prick, really, a bit of a cad. And what that does to her and to her trust. And then she meets a young Algerian man and a relationship with him, which then this other life of him, which is his need and his devotion to Islam. And her experiences of wanting to be with him to the point that she thinks I need to convert. And it examines that, which is where a large part of the attraction of the book lies, because religious conversion kind of fascinates me. So that relationship falls apart as well. There's the loss of children, there's childbirth things. I'm not sure what we do with spoiler alerts here. It's quite a small story. I don't mean that as an insult. I do love a book where it references other writers. There's a lot of talk about Albert Camus, which, as I've just discovered, doesn't rhyme with bus. But also, I did know that. It's a TISM reference. Talking about Islam, about being a Muslim, about converting. It's about these romantic relationships and how trust and mistrust and
a sort of mystery, isn't it? You're inside her world and her worldview and perspective.
Yes.
And it's not clear, like, what's so interesting about this guy, Peter, who she meets on the first page. I mean, why is she so taken with him, so obsessed with him? And I wonder if we're not seeing a character.
I think about this daily with every friend of mine.
Mm. Oh, really?
Why this person?
But it sort of becomes fascinating, doesn't it? Because it's as if she defines herself totally by these relationships. And so you're searching to find her in the midst of it. And she's got enough self-awareness as she's written that she knows that she's sometimes subsuming parts of herself. Or we get glimpses of her as a child where she'd been this more curious, outgoing, exuberant character, and she'd been taught that she sort of had to repress that. She had to hide those sides of herself. So I think, do you think we're wondering, as she's wondering, what it is that makes her?
Yes. Gee, I'm going to think about that on the drive home, because I was wondering why I wasn't affected very much by this book. I read it twice and I didn't enjoy it a hell of a lot. And I'm thinking, is this because I'm on tour? Is it because I'm a gentleman in his autumnal years? You know, what
you
is
are
it?
Not. This,
oh, no, the autumn is here. Winter is very closely approaching in the Rogers story. But then reading Academy Street as well, very much about a young woman who grew up in the 40s in regional Ireland and being completely enthralled by this gentleman and subsuming everything to them. And where is this human? With Anna, it's only really in the final pages that you get more of a sense of it. I mean, she's there, she's kind of not, but I felt annoyed. And so I couldn't really remove myself away thinking about the writing of the book and what was wonderful about it, because my annoyance at really the way that these gentlemen were. I fell into that trap, really, of getting annoyed with characters rather than standing aside and thinking, hang on, now why is this working?
This is a very, very interesting point that we've come across here, because what is it if you aren't influenced by the other person in a relationship? What is it if you aren't taken somewhere else entirely by their passion or their questions or their mysteries? I mean, that's what it's all about. Isn't that every fantastic novel ever written, from Wuthering Heights to, I don't know, this one perhaps? I mean, that's an essential question of the relationship, I suppose, and here we go. I mean...
I have Hello, psychoanalyst listening into this.
I'm really curious about this sort of thing, though, because I think that can work really well. But I wondered, I mean, I haven't read this book. I did read Academy Street way back, 2014 or something, mm-hmm. and loved her as a stylist. But in this book, is there a moment where we see her in her awareness of how she's being shaped by these men who she's, you know, having these romances or relationships with? Is she aware of the way that she's being changed? And if so, does she kind of try to rebel against it? In other words, do we ever see her sort of in agency?
In a relationship with her therapist, who's an older Irish woman, only then. And I reread that section again this morning. It's only then that I thought, aha, okay, I kind of needed this, because there's a flight to America and to New York, very much like Academy Street had it. And I thought, oh, really? Are we here again? A young Irish woman escaping to New York to find herself. But it's mainly the talks with her therapist where you get that, okay, there's a development in this character. It's not just this litany of kind of gentlemen who live these lives and seem to be taking so much from Anna and not giving it a hell of a lot back.
I mean, there is the therapy role, and she's really into Jung. So it's a particular Jungian approach to the world and to dreams and to prophecies that shapes the book. But I think we see glimpses of who else she is and what else she believes in through her reading and her relationship to art, because she does read Camus and she reads other things, and that's what she's always longing for, are these other interior stories and interior lives. And although we do see these relationships, and I take your point, Cassie, that of course being immersed and being swept away by the excitement of relationships is one thing, but with these particular relationships, it's more that she's being controlled and shut down by them.
Her excitement with Islam is fascinating, and to go and to talk about the rituals and the processes, I mean, that's really nourishing. I enjoy that great deal, but then it's at the sacrifice. I'm going to choose my words carefully here, because the character, Anna, feels that is at the sacrifice of the literary, the artistic life that she's getting so much succor from. And she, towards the end of the book, it's a very short novel, it's only about 212 pages, she has to sacrifice one for the other, which is a massive question. Maybe that's where the large question is.
And she's cut off, isn't she? She's sort of cut off from other people by these particular relationships. I mean, she's with Peter for 15 years or something.
15 years too long, yes.
Yeah, he is pretty awful, isn't he? I mean, you do get caught up with him.
It's a technical term.
I know that guy. he's so goddamn familiar.
We've all met a few.
Well, and he treats her with great affection and warmth, and then he disappears. And so at one point there's this line I was really taken about by, and this is how it goes, this oscillating life. So she never knows at the beginning which version of him she's going to get, if he's going to turn up, if he's going to ignore her, if he's going to go off hiking. And so that sense that she's being hurled around the place emotionally, I thought, was done really well in this novel.
And then after something happens to him, her continuing affection for him, and what a lost boy he was, what a lost man. Oh, spare me.
Oh, but maybe that's the lesson. I mean, maybe she had to be with this person and then realise all those things. And thank God it was only 15 years. I mean, maybe that's an alternative reading of it. I don't know. I'm just putting it out there.
You do keep coming back to that question of why this was the pivotal thing that changed everything, and what it means that she's looking back at the age of 45 on her younger self and her life for over the previous 25 years and what she makes of it. So it's a sort of quiet contemplative book in a way. So it's all about interior lives and stories, and then it keeps on expanding to dreams and therapy, and that's where it expands to rather than into action.
Yes, that's right.
Look, for argument's sake, let me just make the case of Jane Eyre. So off Jane goes, she has all these trials and tribulations. She meets men who are constantly offering things and not really coming up with the goods. She falls in love with this man who we then find has his first wife locked in the attic. Somehow the house burns down and that wife dies. And then Jane is
reunited with Mr. Rochester, and we realise at the end that he's the one who truly sees her and truly makes her a fully rounded individual, the only person she's ever met, except for maybe her childhood friend who lives for about 1 month. That's the mystery of that book. That's incredible. So I'm putting that out there as another option for the way that relationships do eventually raise the subterranean and their meaning becomes more clear.
But I think with this character, it's not a relationship and another person that actually sees her. She has to work out ways to see herself. And it's deciding what that mirror is, whether it's another person or whether it's artwork or literature or sort of psychoanalysis. And she comes to that instead, because what you keep on seeing is these other characters who don't see her. And that's the great thing that's missing, I think, is you actually want them to see her rather than to see their own versions of the world, which is what they're replicating over and over again.
Mm. Well, Kate, it's actually when Mr. Rochester goes blind that he truly sees Jane. I can see a spin-off podcast here.
Comparing every book to Jane Eyre and seeing if it
pretty
tops
much.
Up.
Yeah. Or Wuthering Heights, one or the other.
Reminds me that I really must read Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights.
Oh, yeah.
I always walk out of here with large lists of things to
read. Oh, can you report back on those?
Oh, I'd love to.
Okay, good.
Yeah, no, this is the reason I do it. It's the greatest part of my month.
Oh,
well, and in this one, it's looking at the world through Camus and Boris Pasternak. So she is definitely using other texts in which to reevaluate the world and her own life, both as a character, and I suspect that's also what Mary Costello is doing as a writer. So this is about books that are in conversation with other books. They're just choosing 20th century novels rather than 19th century ones.
It did give me occasion to watch Dr. Zhivago in a desultory Belconnen hotel room the other night. So
books just,
you know, when I do have friends, a lot of acquaintances and friends who don't read fiction at all, and they'll say, oh, I have to, you know, you get the bloody dictionary. I think that's the greatest. So did a lot of reading of Camus and Pasternak, and there were some other references in here. I love that stuff where it's littered. It's geographically, say, for example, Iceland. And then you read this brilliant novel and you need to know more about Iceland. It's one of the great gifts that fiction gives you.
Yeah.
So
bravo.
Well, at times I was breathless with the intensity of this novel. It did hit me at times, this one, as well as my irritation with the character Peter, of course, too. Mm. What was he again?
Oh, a prick.
Yeah,
that's the word we're looking for.
it's the etymology of the term. It's derived from the Kalgoorlie mines.
I think from now on, anyone listening to this, if they ever actually come across a P-R-I-C-K, they should just nod to themselves and their friends and say, Peter Gallagher.
Peter Gallagher, an American actor as well.
Sorry to all the Peter Gallaghers listening.
Yeah, yes. Sorry to Mr. and Mrs. Gallagher and their sons, Peter.
But, of course, we're talking about fictional characters here, the creations of Mary Costello, and her novel is called A Beautiful Loan, which is published by Text.
And that review was brought to you by Emily Bronte, Charlotte Bronte, Peter Gallagher, and Chisholm.
And Jung.
And Jung.
And Jung, yeah.
Well, look, thank you both for your reviews. But we want to know what else you've been reading. Hannah Kent, some recommendations for us.
Oh, I finally read Michelle de Kretz's Theory and Practice, which I've been wanting to do for a very long time now. But I listened to it. I listened to it as an audiobook, which was wonderful. I listened to a lot of it when I was in the kitchen cooking one weekend. I don't know, my absorption of the story feels very conversational, as though I was hanging out in the share house and I could really picture the Michelle-esque character, the narrator there with me. I loved it. I was so utterly absorbed by it. I'm sure my kids at one point were trying to talk to me and I just put them on, you know, on airplane mode and just continued listening. I really loved it. I also read Jacqueline Maley's Lonely Mouth, which I really liked as well. And finally, a book that I don't know, I kept hearing about it, people kept on telling me to read it, was The 10-Year Affair by Erin Summers, which is you know, I found very funny, but also when I finished it, just kind of wanted to weep. And I mean, maybe it's following on from your discussion of Mary Costello's book too, but it did make me ask the question, you know, are the straights okay? And I think this book seems to suggest that they are absolutely not. But I enjoyed it nonetheless. So, yeah, quite an interesting little gathering of books there.
That's great.
Tim Rogers, you're just launching your way into a solo tour around the country. Mm-hmm. Does that mean you have more or less time to read?
It will give me more time. I just finished a tour yesterday with the Hard-Ons and Red Cross, old friends, and so it was 3 weeks of chaos. Didn't have a hell of a lot of time to read, but when I tour by myself, I drive myself everywhere, catch trains or buses, whatever. And so I do. I had great experience recently. The town I live in, 500 people. The town up the road has 700. So it's like a civil war going on because they have a pub and we don't. And I found myself in the pub speaking to a gentleman who apparently is a lawyer called Shane. And it was about a year and a half ago. And he said, Rogers, you live in this town and what do you think of The Dubliners by Joyce? And I said, well, of course, you know. And he had this big chat about The Dead with me. And I hadn't read The Dead since I started it 30 years ago. And then I hadn't seen him in a year and a half. And I was crossing a road in Castlemaine. And he went, Rogers, have you read Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain? I said, no, Shane, in similar Stentonian language. And he said, you got to read it. And then he proceeded on. So I got a copy of Magic Mountain and I'm really enjoying it. And then on the Sunshine Coast the other day, found Colm Tóibín's book, The Magician, which is about Thomas Mann.
Yeah, oh, it's wonderful. It's a great book.
So I just love that, that Stentonian voiced gentleman in my country town will shout out book suggestions to me. And also reading a book by a gentleman called Steve Hanley, who played bass in a British post-punk rock group called The Fall. And he was their bass player for 20 years. And the lead singer of The Fall, Mark E. Smith, who died a few years ago, was a fascinating character, but also quite horrible. And so sometimes when you're on tour with a rock band, reading about another band on tour and how horrible it can make you feel a little bit better about yourself.
Right, yeah, I get that, yeah.
Do you listen to audiobooks as you're driving from gig to gig?
Yeah, really do. I anything without ads, so a lot of podcasts I won't listen to apart from The Bookshelf and a few others. But, yes, love listening to audiobooks on tour. I very rarely listen to music on tour, particularly when I'm writing, as I am at the moment. So, yes, lots and lots of audiobooks. And I find it doesn't distract from my driving at all yet. Listening to Bill Evans' piano music, for example, I can drift off and then I'm a danger.
Yeah, well, touch wood. That sounds good. And this is a good moment to remind people that the ABC has a range of audiobooks, which are free, and a whole batch of them that have been narrated, read, whatever the appropriate word is, by young Australian actors. So have a look over there. You might find something you really like.
And thank you so much for those recommendations, which, of course, we will list on the Bookshelf page at Radio National. Hannah and Tim, thanks so much for joining us to talk books again.
Great
always
having you.
Always a pleasure.
Such a delight. Love talking to you always.
We do. Love it, Tim. Too.
Fantastic. And we'll do it all again.
Ripper.
Tim Rogers is a musician and performer and definitely not a Peter Gallagher. And his memoir is Detours. Hannah Kent is a novelist and scriptwriter. Her memoir is Always Home, Always Homesick.
That's it for this edition of The Bookshelf. Next time, Australian writer Michael Winkler's Grief Dog, Native American novelist Louise Erdrich's Python's Kiss, Japanese writer Mako Kawakami's Sisters in Yellow, and another writerly memoir to tell you all about, Alex Miller's Journey to the End of Time.
Well, that is a pretty good bunch of books, so don't miss it. Same time, same place next week. I'm Cassie McCullough.
I'm Kate Evans. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.